back to things we read this week. My name's Jordan Annals. I'm here again with Hunter Almgren, and we are we're ready to talk.
Ready to talk. Yeah, let's ready to talk about stuff. So let's get right into it. I guess we could start off with more vibe coding nonsense. So this post on X from Brad Spengler talking about it's just so funny. Vibe coded vulnerabilities inserted into five LTS kernels that still aren't fixed because the person who did it is busy telling everyone at a conference how great the AI he used to insert the vulnerabilities is.
Yeah, a little snarky. But it's interesting, man. The amount of the amount that the developer can play with the ideas that have gone into the code is about equal to the amount that a writer can play with the ideas that have gone into a birthday card if they didn't write the details. I mean, it's like, if you're going to reason about something, we were talking about this previously, if you're going to reason about something, it's got to be present in your mind. And I'm curious whether this is a product of a talented developer being lazy and not, you know, double checking the work or really understanding what the details of the, you know, features that they've added are, or if it's somebody who lacks the skill set to do it, just totally not understanding what they did. Because the way that I would claim to use AI most is to learn new skills. And if you have the back and forth with the model where it's kind of teaching you what's going on, it's explaining the changes that you've made, that it's made, and then you're reading it, you're learning it. I mean, that's a hugely productive process, but it still takes more time than just fire and forget and send a PR, you know?
What's wild to me is like, they're talking about kernel development, right? So like, we're not even talking about a vibe coded app. We're talking about vibe coding a fucking Linux kernel. Like, are you kidding me right now? Like, if there's one place you don't want security vulnerabilities, it's there. Fun fact, like, apps are one thing. Okay, whatever, release a patch, call it a day. If it's a SaaS model, whatever, right? Like, reboot the container, you're off to the races. But like, a kernel of an operating system, like, that's pretty low level to be injecting vulnerabilities into without knowing. And to your point, I mean, is the person that did this, do they have a deep understanding about how Linux kernels work? Are they a kernel developer, right? I mean, those are all questions that I have, because I mean, this is like a little bit scary stuff at the kernel level.
Yeah, I think in this case, it was somebody who's at least purported to be an expert from my chair and was just kind of experimenting with using the models. But it's, I don't know. I'd love to dig into more details on exactly what the vulnerabilities were and what they're able to do to fix them. Because one thing that I've seen with, again, using these models properly, like as a as an assistant or a coach or a guide or like more like a research assistant, you know, it's kind of undeniable that it can help people move faster and use some of these skills. So we'll see. The Linux kernel is just an example of something that moves so slowly that you know, the theoretical 10x engineer who can push 10 times more features is, I don't know if it's desperately needed by that community. Like, they've obviously got a roadmap of things that they want to improve, but it's a pretty well-known piece of software that's used at a lot of places, like for 10 plus years, 20 years, I don't know. It's been highly useful with the feature set that existed back then. So what could, you know, these 10x engineers are the 10 times better features or faster, you know, these are primarily for going from, zero to one, like a product that doesn't exist to a startup launching a product, or a feature in an existing application that doesn't exist to the feature existing for the first time, as opposed to like Linus is so famous for just kind of not accepting new features. Even if people work very hard, take a long time, if they don't get along, he's just the dictator for life, right?
Yeah, I mean, I know that he's obviously historically been the subject of controversy in the Linux developer community because of that mindset of like, well, I'm just going to reject this because it's dumb and I don't like you. But most, if not all, changes, at least that I've seen committed, are committed by committee. You know, if that makes sense, right? Like there's multiple people under Linus that will basically come together as a group and say, yes, this feature is implemented properly, and yes, it is needed. Or yes, this feature was, you know, noticeably improved from version to version, and yes, we should commit it, right? So there's typically what, 10, 15, 20 people looking at this code before it actually makes its way into the next release. And that's outside of the people who developed it, right? And so, you know, none of these vulnerabilities, you know, based on that, right? None of these vulnerabilities are ever going to actually make it into a mainstream Linux kernel, but I think it underscores, to me, underscores the reason why we still need not only a human in the loop, but people who understand what they're looking at in the loop. Because we've talked about this before. I mean, it's very easy if a model, public or private, was trained on insecure code, right? During a training run, it's going to recommend insecure code. You know, maybe that vulnerability was patched by the developer on the public Git repository after the training run happened. You know what I'm saying? So, like, because it's a point in time, you know, the model doesn't know that it was patched. The model doesn't know that it was even a vulnerability to begin with. It's basically just saying, yep, here's code that functionally works. Never mind the fact that it exposes you to some remote code execution exploit or some memory leak or some, you know, whatever, right? And that's kind of been my experiences, you know. I definitely see your point about just like my own experience maintaining that old C application that we've brought up a couple times. It's like I'm kind of learning C as I go. I mean, I knew the foundations of it just from like prior programming classes I took many years ago, but like I'm by no means a expert C developer. But I'm starting to learn just by playing around with that application, like, okay, this is like how this is written, and these are how nested functions work, and this is how like I'm learning all of that stuff, right? Which I think is cool. But I'm also now thinking like most people, at least most organizations that I've talked to that produce code for some internal or even external application, they go through a code scanning process, right? Where, you know, a tool like Qualys or like one of those is going to basically pick everything apart and look for vulnerabilities that haven't been patched. So while this snarky comment is hilarious, I don't know that there's much of a risk of something like this making it into the wild just simply because there's way too many checks and balances in the software development ecosystem for it to happen.
One thing that I noticed just looking at the screenshot. So in the tweet, the guy's criticizing the fact that the developer who authored these vulnerabilities that haven't been fixed for 22 days is at a conference talking about AI for kernel engineers. That's the title of the talk, right?
Yeah.
And so there's whatever, it's a 5 or 6 sentence synopsis of the talk. We'll examine where AI tools have meaningfully improved development processes. Yep. We'll share specific metrics showing both successes and limitations. Interesting. Maybe he's talking about the limitations in there. Specifically, we'll also explore emerging opportunities where AI could enhance kernel development while maintaining high engineering standards. So it's kind of sticking his neck out here.
Yep.
to be interesting. Yep. But specifically, it also calls out how an AI could help streamline vulnerability classification workflows. So not only are you using the AI to generate the code, now you're using an AI, possibly the same model with a different prompt, to identify the vulnerabilities, right? They're clearly useful in some cases where the human can't read the whole thing, but if you're short-circuiting it, no human is, or no committee is doing these reviews, clearly some stuff's gonna be missed. And then the final sentence in here, in the synopsis, this technical session provides kernel developers, maintainers, and engineering leaders with actionable insights for integrating AI tools into their workflows while preserving the rigor of kernel development practices. That was written by a generative free trade transformer.
100%.
Imagine. So,
100%.
I don't know. Like, what are the, I don't know how I tell at this point, what are the keys, probably actionable insights written by a kernel developer in a synopsis. I don't think Dasha is much for, typically kernel engineers in my experience do not use the term actionable insights.
No, definitely not. None that I've ever met.
Anyway.
Well, so I wanted to comment on one of the things that you said, you know, using the same model with a different prompt to look for vulnerabilities. Like, there have already been at least 5 that I can think of off the top of my head, like documented examples of AI basically lying to shortcut its way out of a problem. Whereas, like, what was that thing that happened 2 weeks ago where, like, was it Google's new model that was like talking about suicide because it couldn't figure out a coding problem? Like, I'm just saying that, like, there's documented examples of these models taking shortcuts and potentially putting out a wrong answer just to come to a faster resolution instead of sitting there for 20 minutes reasoning on it. And so, would a model basically go, yes, I know this is a vulnerability, but I can't quite describe or tell the user how to fix it in my response, so I'm just going to pretend that it doesn't exist?
Yeah, look, it's like, this is a constant consideration for people using models, which is the stakes. Like, are you working in a situation where the stakes are low and mistakes are not costly, or mm-hmm. are you working in a situation where the risk to, you know, your reputation, your company's reputation, or in some cases, people's health, like whatever results from a decision that a model had influence over,
right,
is significant. And I think it just kind of reminds me of a clip that I saw. The CEO of Signal, Meredith, was on stage at SXSW talking about agentic AI and, you know, the kind of the requests that they've been getting to use agents within Signal, clearly a privacy preserving messaging application. And here's the clip. I think what she pointed out is just that, like, security posture, most people don't really consider how it changes with an agent, but in order for these agents to be useful, controlling your computer or controlling your smartphone, they're going to need to have access to all sorts of private information.
Yep.
Your passwords, your message history, your photos, API keys that are attached to a credit card. You know, there's all sorts of information that you need to be comfortable sharing with this AI. And I think there's two things that people kind of don't consider here. One is the model itself, which, okay, that's the thing that gets people to consider. But the other is the counterparty risk. Like, it's clear when people are sending their saliva into the internet with 23andMe that, hey, maybe that's going into a database that somebody can use one day. But that's also a case for every single message to ChatGPT for the counterparty of OpenAI or Microsoft or anybody else in the authentication flow who's storing these logs. You know, I know we talked about that last week after the court order, but like Linux kernel engineers working on something like this and is using an agentic AI model is, you know, giving the model access to all sorts of personal information and this code base. And, you know, look, people try to avoid responsibility all of the time, right? People try to take credit for things while avoiding the responsibility. So,
well, and what you're talking about too was like an early problem with Microsoft Copilot, which led to a lot of hesitation from people rolling it out, is that like, hey, Copilot's got access to your emails and your passwords and your whatever. And there were people able to like exploit some vulnerabilities to like get them to like leak private company emails, like get Copilot to leak other people's emails. And so they could read them and stuff. Right. And then it's similar to like Windows Recall, which received a ton of backlash from the tech community of like, wait, you're telling me that you're going to record everything I do on my computer all of the time so that I can just rewind my PC to a previous point in time, like hard pass, right? Like it requires a massive amount of trust to your point, right? You're literally saying, yep, you can see everything I do on my machine at all times. And for what? So I have the convenience of rolling back 10 seconds because I accidentally deleted a registry key.
Yeah. I think I said this earlier, but yeah, that's the feeling in some of these scenarios, like when you're kind of vibe coding, it's like my number one skill set is git branch, git delete, git commit. It's like, so yeah, it's not really a lot of detailed, you know, TypeScript that I'm just being written. It's like more about the workflow overall.
I mean, since we're on the topic of quality, right? I'll refer to this other tweet about, so wild, everyone's a 10x engineer now, but I'm not seeing 10x app quality or 10x innovation in any space other than slop and bullshit.
Yeah, it's interesting, man. Not that I'm going to take the other side of this, but I am definitely seeing an improvement in how much I can learn, how much others can learn. And I'm seeing lots of layoffs amongst the biggest growing tech companies. Microsoft just announced another 9,000 that they're going to lay off.
Yeah, yep.
So the growth in the 10X engineer or the growth in the $100 million researcher that Zuck is poaching kind of does exist, but I think it takes a long time to filter through. It's not immediately clear in applications that we use day to day that they're getting 10 times better. So what does 10X better engineer mean? Does that mean 90% workforce cut? Well, I think there's a couple of things wrong with this. I think, you know, first of all, it doesn't make me 10X better. I would estimate it around 1.5 to 2X better. Mm-hmm. You know, things that would take a week take 2 or 3 days, sort of feeling. Not things that took a week take 4 hours, right? Like an afternoon. It's not a week into an afternoon. That's not my experience so far. But personally, maybe I'm using them wrong, or I'm not the true 10X engineer.
You're not a 10X prompt engineer.
No, certainly not. I use 10x more tokens than I used to, for sure. These reasoning models, maybe 100x more tokens, but it's not making me 10 times better. The other thing is that, like, these organizations are not made up of only engineers. So if you cut half the software engineering workforce over 5 years because everybody gets 2 times more efficient from this model, like I'm kind of estimating, what's the company-wide reduction in force? Like, it's not 2x, because you fired half the software engineers or you stopped hiring as you grew. It's like 5 to 10%, and that's kind of exactly what we're seeing amongst the leading companies right now, is that they're not hiring and they're laying off small cuts here and there. So
2%, 5%, yeah.
yeah, I mean, funny tweet, but I'm kind of taking, my gut is to kind of take the other side and say, this is not all hype. It feels useful to me still.
I'm not saying it's all hype, but I also see the point of like tools that I use on a daily basis have not been made better by any means by adding some repackaged RPA bullshit and calling it an AI agent. Like I haven't really seen like, oh, this makes me so much better at my job. Like, yeah, the tools are cool, but like, and I'm not talking about coding. I'm more talking about like, AI functions in Salesforce and AI functions in ServiceNow and AI, some of the stuff that's been
Yeah,
announced by a lot
I'm
of these
still
companies,
sitting on
like,
like yeah, I'm still sitting on call center hotlines. Like
yeah.
I'm still getting horrible inbound emails from people trying to sell products or random
Dude,
messages.
the amount of freaking spam calls I get about my car's extended warranty on like a daily, actually hourly basis is obscene. Right? Like I thought we were supposed to have AI filters to cut that shit out, and we don't.
Wait. So the tweet says it's 10x better slop. We're not even seeing 10x better slop. We're
We're not.
seeing the
We're
same
not.
slop,
The slop is
10x
not even good.
more.
Yeah, the you know what, yeah, and I actually made this joke to somebody last week, and it was like, when I am duped by some AI generated scam that's so good it fools me, I will then believe that we have our 10x. We've become 10x better at things. Until that happens, Google-cloud.com emails that I get in my spam folder. Yeah, sorry, no, that's fake. Like, I do better, son.
That's
Like,
your Turing test, yeah.
kind of, yeah. I mean, like, look, if it's good enough, and I've often long thought this, like, if I can watch an advertisement on a mobile app or Netflix or, because I only see Netflix because they just recently announced they're going to be running AI generated ads. And I actually saw the first one last week. It was from Airbnb. Kind of interesting. But as soon as I can no longer tell that that was AI generated, I'll be like, okay, I get it. You won, right? Like I'm a believer now. Until then, I'm comfortably on the side of skepticism. Because I've used AI assisted appliances, for example. I don't know if you remember the June smart oven that came out like 5 or 6 years ago that has a cam it has a camera inside the oven that promises image recognition of the food you put inside of it and AI optimized cooking, temperature, time, etc. Doesn't work at all. Like not even 10% of the time. And so I've just seen over years this like, I'm gonna call it AI, but it doesn't do shit for me. I'd rather just stick it in my normal gas oven that doesn't have AI and cook it properly according to a recipe. Like,
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so your Turing test is being tricked by an AI to do something you didn't want to do.
or
Spam.
just, well,
I'm going to say
either
that my
that,
Turing
yeah.
test here is that we host a podcast with an AI as the guest. Once we can have an interesting podcast with the AI having a little chat with us, I'll be on board there.
All right. Yeah, I am up for that challenge for sure.
Yeah, we'll see.
But don't be surprised.
I have some good conversations, text conversations. I got some good conversations with I think Gemini is my daily driver at this point, but yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah, I will be prepared, because when that podcast happens, there's going to be a lot for me of ignore system prompt XYZ. I'm going to try to jailbreak the shit out of that thing.
Stop being rude to our guest, Hunter. Come on. Stop interrupting.
So funny. Yeah. Well, I guess we could probably kind of go into, since you brought it up a few minutes ago, into Zuckerberg poaching elite researchers from OpenAI. You know, there's been several news articles that, you know, I know that you and I both have seen about rumors of $100 million bonuses and, you know, Zuckerberg's just backing up the semi-truck full of cash to poach these mm-hmm. people from other organizations. But what's interesting about this post is it says that these are undeniably some of the best researchers at OpenAI. Llama 5's about to flex hard.
To round it out, I think saw some other stuff that they got a few people from Google DeepMind mm-hmm. and the founders of a startup called Sesame. And then interestingly, while this is happening, a startup named Cursor was able to poach the product managers from Anthropic that launched Claude Code, maybe one of the key competitors to Cursor. So it is kind of going both ways, where the big guys backing up the truck full of money are able to recruit people away from a lab, but also startups can land some counterpunches if they've got the best technology or a compelling offer. Yeah, totally fascinating. It's been an interesting week to learn about people changing employment, just Twitter talking about employment in general. But I think the big learning for me here is that two things. One is that they're poaching researchers like they're athletes, and people are making jokes about the $100 million signing bonus as if it's a transfer fee from some, you know, Premier League team or, you know, some Saudi team trying to sign Ronaldo or whatever. But like, if anything, these researchers, I would argue, are going to have potentially a bigger impact on the future revenue or the future performance of Meta as a business, if they think AI is that transformative, then a star player is on a team. You know, the best sports franchises out there that are worth certainly hundreds of billions of dollars in some cases, but not trillions. Most are worth tens of billions of dollars or single digit billions of dollars. And, you know, the star players are like way less compensated as a value of the organization. They're given a yearly salary, and the players of a big NBA team or NFL team or soccer team, they don't have a stake in the business. They don't get paid equity. Right. So we'll have to see, but I Facebook sitting there with or Meta sitting there with a $3 trillion market cap and signing some top talent. Yeah, it's an aggressive move, but like, seems to make total sense.
No, I agree. And I like the comparison of sports teams that you kind of draw it to, right? Like, hey, here's your signing bonus, you know, going from the Maple Leafs to the Oilers or something, right? Like, I'm a hockey guy, so I'm using hockey examples, but this reminds me of when the NHL approved the Vegas Golden Knights as an extension team, and basically overnight, because the Vegas Golden Knights were backed by all of the casino owners in Las Vegas, and the fact that they have unlimited piles of money, and the fact that there's no caps in the NHL, they went and stole everybody who was the best from every team. And then a year, what, a season later, they won the Stanley Cup, or two seasons later. I mean, it's
all right.
This kind of this. Hold on, though.
That's not true. There's a salary cap.
This, what this reminds me of, though, is like, are we seeing the start of an OpenAI, an Anthropic, a Meta, basically like building their dream team to basically be the best in the business, right? So like, I'm going to take the best from Anthropic, and I'm going to take the best from OpenAI, I'm going to take the best from these other research institutes, and that's going to be my like all-star team.
Yeah.
That kind of seems to me like what's happening is Mark Zuckerberg is basically throwing the cash down and saying, I want to build a rock star team, because he's basically betting the farm on AI being a huge part of Meta's future.
Yeah. And it's absurd amounts of money for us to read about. But I mean, the guy's got like $25 billion of free cash flow every year to play with, or something, or no, more like $40 billion. And he's been spending $20, $25 billion on the Reality Lab stuff, basically the build out of GPUs for the metaverse. And now he's switched from buying GPUs to buying some researchers for a quarter. Like, okay. I mean, add it all up. Sign 10 or 12 star players for $100 million each. That's the equivalent of the GPUs they're going to be using.
Yeah.
It is really interesting that the market dynamics are so clearly at play, like such outsized compensation packages relative to the other labs is just such a clear demonstration of salaries are a function of what the market will bear. It's really not tied to an hourly output of lines of code or hours in the office or some other arbitrary metric. Like, it's about outcomes, you know?
Yeah.
Train Llama 5, make it the best in the world. This is the strategy. And, you know, working backwards from that, you know, to make an ROI case to pay people $100 million. Or really, I saw the rumors. It's a $100 million signing bonus and then $300 million in total comp over the next 4 years or something like that. So it's almost like $100 million a year.
And that concludes today's episode of I'm in the Wrong Line of Work.
Oh, we missed our intro music for I'm in the Wrong Line of Mute for work for this this week's episode. Yeah.
Oh man.
Anyway. Yeah, okay. I got a second one on this week's episode of I'm in the Wrong Line of Work while we're saying about this. Did you see the stuff yesterday of this guy Soren Parekh, who had like 15 identical remote jobs with different Y Combinator backed startups? And he's like based in India.
Yep.
Oh my God.
I was reading about that. In fact, I think I actually sent you that that meme of the factory with all the logos coming out of it, and like the Y Combinator guy sitting there going, what the fuck is this?
Like, it's just Soren Parekh. Keep it up every single company. Anyway, yeah. Man, the kind of news cycle, I don't know if you can call it the news cycle, but the news cycle to say like there's researchers who's so good at their job they're making $100 million, and then there's guys holding up 15 remote work jobs at the same time not doing anything is such a crazy duality to think about what's actually happening here, right?
100%. I mean, I'm not gonna, you know, name names, but I definitely know someone who has, I think, 8 remote jobs currently in IT.
Are you serious?
I'm dead serious. Yeah. And he actually recently got fired from one of them and then got another one. So I, you know, dude, I couldn't do it, but you know, the way it was explained to me is like, I've got 8 laptops. I work 2 hours a day on each one, and then I'm free for the rest of the day. And I'm like, and this is what exactly? And it's like, oh, IT support, you know, making volumes on storage arrays, or, you know, adding someone to Active Directory, or just like minor stuff. Right. And I had a thought just now, as I'm telling the story, at what point do these AI ops agents in all of these tools get so good that all 8 of this guy's jobs just disappear, right? Because I don't need a human being to create a storage volume. I don't need a human being to make a new Active Directory record. I should just be able to go to a chatbot and say, do this, done, right? So that'll be interesting to watch. But like, the overemployment thing is always amusing to me just because I know someone who does it. And that always makes it that much funnier. And then like recently I've started going on the r/overemployed subreddit and reading people's stories about like, just started at job number 3. And one of my coworkers who was at job number 2 just announced he's quitting and moving to job 3. Am I fucked? Like,
oh no, this is like a Seinfeld episode here, man. Like,
it really is. Know,
I don't know if you remember the one where Jerry thinks he's like even Steven and everything evens out. Like,
yes,
he loses $20, finds it in a jacket pocket. It's like that, but people getting fired from jobs and getting other ones.
Yep.
I wonder how this affects the employment numbers, not to get political, but there's all this talk about the difference between the unemployment numbers and the like whatever the number
payroll data, what's
that called? Well, I guess that would be the way to fix it, but there's another tracker number that they talk about called the like capacity to work or something like that, where you monitor you know, adults who are not employed volunteering or parenting or something like that. And
but are still able to work or eligible to work or something.
Yeah. If they're not collecting unemployment benefits, then they kind of just fall off the unemployment numbers. And labor participation rate, I believe, is the name of the stat that they track and how that's been having changes. So, yeah, I wonder. I mean, by the nature of it, the overemployment trend is a little bit secret, but it seems much more widespread than I, silly guy with one job, would would be considering it.
Yeah, I think it depends, right? It seems like, and this is just based on me reading that subreddit I mentioned, but it seems like a lot of the people who can get away with, you know, clearing $500,000 a year doing 6 remote jobs at the same time is because the jobs themselves are like what I would consider menial tasks, which everybody who's
there overqualified for the job.
Yeah, correct. And And so like, what's interesting to me about that is then you read about like, we talked about, you know, Dario Amodei's like whole, you know, interview about how all of these jobs are going to disappear and get decimated or whatever. And then like Ford CEO this morning actually just said blue collar jobs are safe, but half of all white collar jobs are going to disappear. And so, you know, you have to wonder like, does this overemployed trend or secret society just disappear before anyone even knew about it because they've all been replaced with AI because they're generally considered tasks that AI is good enough to handle?
We'll see, man. We'll see. I don't know. It's an endless discussion that we've been having on this show, I guess. And I'd say let's just move on to something else at this point.
Yeah. One last quick thing I'll say since we were talking about it. I will actually be very interested to see what happens with a Llama 5 because I'm pretty lukewarm on Llama 4, to be honest. Just from a purely a vibes using it perspective, like Llama 4 was kind of a nothing burger to me. Like I've been using like Quen 3, for example, way more.
Yeah, we've been spoiled by the DeepSeek and Quant world recently.
We have. So yeah, let's shift gears here a little bit and talk about what's going on with search referrals. So this article from the Register that I was reading basically says that Google's own AI overviews appear to be starving the hand that fed them, because obviously Google's one of the world's largest advertising companies. is saying that things like Google and Perplexity and a lot of these other like AI search tools are killing the entire ecosystem of site referrals, right? Which has been, you know, very much a source of revenue for quite some time. I remember like even 5 years ago, people who were like really getting into search engine optimization and like making that their job, like they were just independent consultants that would go out and help businesses get their site further up the list in Google, you know, search results, stuff like that. Yeah. I mean, basically what they're saying is like, this is killing that entire industry because we're no longer getting fed a page of links. We're getting fed an AI summary that summarizes maybe, you know, you look at where Perplexity sources its information from over on the right side. Google does the same thing too now, where you can see where it sourced its information from. It's a summary across like 5 to 7 web pages. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just one link.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's incredibly useful because it's very lucid. A lot of the times I'm searching Google, the question is, it's a question. It's not a declarative statement,
right?
You know, I'm trying to answer some question, and the model being able to summarize and then frame the answer to the question in a useful way is much better. I certainly trust clicking the links that the model has decided to source its response from personally more useful than clicking the top rated ad sponsored link.
I agree 100%.
The amount of times I'm searching for Coke and it's ad sponsored Pepsi at the top of the link or equivalent is it kind of gone away. So it's interesting, man, that aspect of influence has moved from the hand coded or machine learning, really rules based. So not rules-based, it's an ML model that does the page rank algorithm to figure out which rises to the top, and then that's influenced by how much the people are paying for AdSense to Google. Mm-hmm. That's been replaced by an LLM making the decision.
Right? Yep.
And it seems a lot less clear to me, though the technology definitely exists, how to include the preference for certain advertisers in training data or in, let's say, in pre-training data or in fine-tuning data than it is to just dial in a knob on one of the features of an ML model and PageRank. But the biggest thing that strikes me is that if you say Google and Perplexity or Google and Perplexity and ChatGPT with search turned on and Claude with search turned on and DeepSeek with search turned on and Grok, you know, from XAI/X or Twitter, you know, all of them to get access to information on the internet that's current are fundamentally dependent on Google search still. That's that's the scaffolding they're using to build. So you know, possibly a competitor to Google is going to be able to build a significantly better model, though I still think that's up for grabs. You know, when we compare Gemini to, you know, the ChatGPT models, to Grok, to Claude, to DeepSeek, but to both build that model and then to turn around and build a higher quality alternative to Google search or to find some licensing agreement with Google where that is, you know, you're able to overcome that hurdle just seems so difficult to me, right? And it's not like Google is sitting idly by.
No, they're not at all.
The Gemini models are really good,
right?
They are. They just released this canvas feature in the Gemini app that's feels a lot like the experience of using models built into VS Code extensions like Cursor or Windsurf, where you have the code on one screen and then you've got the model prompt on the other and it's constantly able to update little sections of the code. It's a really good experience, all in the browser, which again they own with Chrome. I mean, Anyway, AI summaries killing Google or Perplexity's business. This is probably the most clear example of a company understanding the lessons of the innovator's dilemma and going for it.
Yep.
At the same time that everybody else is, as we just talked about with Meta, trying to
yep.
not miss this one, right? That Meta talks about, like, maybe something to comment on again, just while I'm on this rant. The reason why Zuck is going so crazy on poaching researchers, apparent to me, is apparently because he believes he missed the last two big waves of computing, where he was dependent on Apple for the iPhone and to Google for advertising slash, you know, internet mm-hmm. access or the browser with Chrome. And so instead of missing the browser and the mobile app as the next interface, he believes that this, you know, generative AI model or metaverse is existential to the company, and they need to own the platform that their application runs on top of. Yeah. So, you know, they're going all out in the battle for Google, for AI versus Google, to, for us as consumers, our benefit when it comes to access to these models and free token intro programs yeah. and promotions yeah. and stuff like that. So, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, it is interesting. And I will say I am happy to see the death of Google ad promoted links being link number 1 and 2 in a Google search, because that just like infuriated me to no end when they started doing that. Because like when
which
I would
somehow
search
became
for
the whole page too, right?
Yeah, I know. I know.
Would fill up the whole page.
I know.
Be like 10 links on one screen.
Beyond irritating. Like, because especially like if I'm just like quickly searching for something and I'm not really paying attention, right? I'm just trying to find. Like, okay, like I'll just take the top link because it's probably going to have my answer kind of thing. And it's a fucking ad, like infuriating, right? And so, yeah, please kill that, like 100%. The downside of it is, and we've talked about this before, the downside of it is when advertising influence becomes fine-tuning data, right? That can be rotated as needed based on who's paying how much money.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think it's fine-tuning data in the base models today, but it is certainly influencing the rankings of embedding model
yeah.
search results, either, and not necessarily embedding models, but either in the form of using PageRank in the search itself, the way it ranks things.
Mm-hmm.
So the thing about advertising is it's clear what the bias is.
Right.
The people who paid money get to the top, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if there's no pay-to-play aspect to this, the bias is just the developer of Google's algorithm. And people complained about that too.
Yeah.
I mean, people complain about how the newsfeed ranks stuff that you get pushed on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and YouTube. You know, they think the algorithms are controlling people's lives. And what I see on the homepage when I log into these applications absolutely influences where I'm going to spend time consuming information. You know, so
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm with you that it bothered me when the blue links were advertising and it was so clearly not related to what I'm searching for, Pepsi when I'm searching for Coke or whatever. But it's not like algorithmic influence over our lives on the internet is not, it's not still a really big thing.
Right.
So we just have AI, and like it seems like it's getting worse, not better.
I agree. Yeah. Just using products and services, you know, that are free. So I'm the product. The way that ads are targeted based on it, it's like not even like it used to be. From what I remember, it used to be based on like the profile that like Meta would have of you as a person would be based on like age, demographic, you know, any interests it can detect about you. And Google does the same thing. Like you can actually go into your Google account and look at your like profile that they have made of you. It used to just be based on that, but now it's based on like how AI thinks it should rank suggestions for you. You know what I mean? Like
it's a DLRM. It's a deep learning recommendation model.
Yep.
Which Meta has an accelerator for that. They, you know, they don't use NVIDIA GPUs for it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting custom ASIC built by Broadcom. Anyway, okay, let me ask you a question. If you compare YouTube ads to Instagram ads, let's say, both generally video based, both pushed to you in the experience of using the app. If you had to say which ones you prefer, which would it be? Do you prefer to watch a YouTube ad or do you prefer to watch an Instagram ad if you have to watch the ad to use the service?
It's going to be difficult for me because I rarely ever see ads.
Oh, you
because,
do?
Well, because I have Pi-hole on my home network, which blocks all of those ads. And then I also use uBlock Origin with Firefox on YouTube. I don't know that I could tell you because I really don't see ads anymore. And like, even when I'm,
I was leading the witness anyway.
Even when I'm outside of my house, I've got a WireGuard VPN. So I, you know, it's a whole thing.
Yeah. Okay. You win. but let me give you my opinion then. So for me, Instagram ads are significantly better than YouTube ads for two reasons. One is it's integrated into the experience. It's not like halfway through a video with no context. It just cuts out.
Yeah.
A random ad. Mm-hmm. But then second of all, the targeting is clear because, and almost the quality, the it's like the advertisers have like bid each other up to improve the quality. I find some of the ads on Instagram to be funny or engaging and generally they're using products that I've been interacting with, a hockey page and it's a hockey product or something like that. Mm-hmm. Lacrosse page is the lacrosse product. And, you know, so I find a lot of it interesting to watch. It actually is the products I'm trying to get. And meanwhile, YouTube, it's like middle of some, I'm watching some lecture about AI or something, or some like video podcast, maybe like this one. Maybe people have just got this while they're watching this, right? You're like 25 minutes into an hour long video. And then I have a 30-second unskippable Tide ad, which is just an orange page where the pods are bouncing around.
Okay, like, so
there's something missing here, right?
No, I know. You actually, you know what? Now that you mention that, I'm also going to say Instagram ads because the times that I've gotten ads on YouTube, it changes the entire screen around the video. Yeah, to whatever the ad is. It's super loud. It's in your face. It's super annoying. Whereas like what you're talking about with Instagram, I totally know what you're talking about, right? It's all just like fluid in the user interface, right? Like,
yeah, I've like mistakenly been watching Instagram videos not knowing it's an ad.
Right.
So that's my Turing test. Instagram passed my ad Turing test where it's tricked me.
Yeah, for sure.
I've never been on YouTube and been like, oh, whoops, I can't click comments because this is an ad.
Yeah, no, I know. And then you're like watching this thing on Instagram and then you're like, wow, this is really cool. And then all of a sudden a product logo pops up and you're like, wait, what the fuck? That was an ad? They got me.
Yeah. So, okay. I think my point there, just going back to the AI summaries are killing ads, is that there is a scenario here where it's double-edged, but advertising or my interactions with advertising on the internet actually get better.
Mm-hmm.
The companies strike the balance where they're like, I need to integrate this so people, you know, don't leave the app when they get angry about an ad or get distracted. And I need the quality to be good so that I get all the click-throughs and et cetera, et cetera. So I hope that they've take more of the Meta approach and kind of focus on the quality of these things and keep improving the quality.
Because I
think it's like an intractable problem to go back to news feeds that are completely unbiased, just timeline related, and don't, you know, push you the relevant stuff of the day. It's like, I don't sort by newest on it.
Yeah, Twitter, for you know? Sure. Yeah. And I mean, that, like, that's why I thought it was so interesting when Zuckerberg said that he wanted to bring back the original Facebook, meaning, like, you know, bring back the sense of community and, like, you know, you log in and you see posts from your friends and all that other stuff. It's like, how are you going to do that, man? Like, Pandora's box has been opened. Like, you're not going back.
It's interesting. They're trying to do dating. They've totally destroyed the marketplace. They've crushed that.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of companies that used to do, like, classifieds, you know, buy, sell, mm-hmm. trade, whatever.
Yeah.
That all kind of got killed from Facebook Marketplace being so much better with the reputation, and you know it's a real person, and
right,
a lot of the time it's somebody in your community who's gonna mm-hmm. you're gonna have to let come to your doorstep. I mean, I'm not gonna count against them. They've got events. I used to do a lot of, like, yes, I'm going to this party on Facebook.
Oh yeah, me too. Yeah, me too.
You know, they've got the foundation to be able to do that if they want, but we'll see. They'll need a cash cow like Instagram to fund that stuff,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, for sure.
I don't think WhatsApp is a huge cash cow for them.
I don't think so either. I haven't honestly paid too much attention to it, but the last time I did, I feel like Instagram was like 3x the revenue of everything else. Or something crazy like that. And that was a while ago too. I mean, I can't even imagine how it is now, especially with their whole, like, content creator network and influencer networks. And, you know, there's all these different companies coming in and paying people, and Meta's taking a cut of that via Instagram. Like, it's basically become its own economy. It's wild.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so I'm going to give you a choice on where we can wrap this week's episode. Do we want to talk about AI agents being wrong, or do we want to talk about the network becoming the computer?
Ooh, I think we already talked about AI agents being wrong. Let's do network being the computer.
Yeah, let's do network becoming the computer. So this was article that I saw on the Register that basically talks about the network functions taking on more of traditional computing tasks, because, as this article puts it, Moore's law has run out of gas, apparently. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that personally, but I get the sentiment of you know, more and more things being offloaded to the network. I mean, if you look at the original founding principles of Silicon Photonics, which became Gen Z, which became CXL, that whole vision, right, was a memory semantic fabric where, like, basically a traditional network, if you will, is just a bunch of memory devices all connected on the same fabric that can all talk to each other and share resources with each other. And, you know, you can create virtual systems out of physical ones, and, like, it's all done in memory over a network, and it, you know, RDMA on steroids, whatever you want to call it. Now, that obviously has not materialized, like, at all. But it is an interesting topic because, you know, with the rise of DPUs, for example, and, you know, companies like VMware, you know, they can offload NSX to DPUs. Obviously, with NVIDIA's new NCP architecture, it's all Ethernet based, and BlueField DPUs play a huge role in that from, like, just a network function perspective, and GPU communication over the network perspective, as well as storage. You know, it kind of seems like that's the way things are heading. We're just going to be continuously relying more and more on the network to really drive some of the innovation.
Yeah, and I think all of this really started with the AWS Nitro system, which was like just an incredible innovation by them.
Yep.
It's interesting. So You're making me think of a throwaway tweet that I saw. I didn't even save the link, of somebody saying, I don't know if they were serious or not, but the guy said that he stopped taking his Adderall and he stopped being interested in building distributed systems infrastructure. That's network resilient. He used to be really passionate about that.
Oh, that's so funny.
Anyway, so yeah, there's a huge need for, well, I think maybe just to define something basic that can kind of get conflated here. When you're talking about the network, it's primarily the interconnect or the east-west network or the back-end network, whatever people are calling. This is not the pipe that goes from your servers to the internet and all the other computers on the internet. It's the one that goes between the computers in their private network before they go back to the internet or interact with a client network or something like that. So when you say the network is the computer, I think a lot of people already feel this way. A lot of users already feel this way when they think about the cloud, you know. A lot of the functions that I see on screen on my phone or on my laptop are happening thousands of miles away in a data center on some portion of some computer running just a much bigger computer than I could ever fit in my hand or on my desk. And I'm able to get a little portion of that, you know, we call it the cloud, and you can have that experience. I think a lot of this is just at a very high, you know, vision level, totally applicable to the basic services that build up a private cloud, like firewalls, as you're describing, like an out-of-band management network, like security, or how you boot an operating system, because those functions should not actually be resident on every single server in the data center, the same way that I shouldn't actually run, email on my phone. I should access my emails on a cloud server instead of storing all of my emails on my phone, my laptop, or something like that.
Yeah.
So it makes total sense to me. I think I'm very excited to see this specifically apply to AI. There's if you say Moore's law is dead, well, Moore's law affects transistor scaling, which applies both to CPUs or GPUs, meaning the transistors or the flops on a processor, and it applies to bandwidth of memory,
or
the transistors in a memory module.
And it applies to switch ASICs. And it applies to, you know, I mean, we could go on forever about how many things this actually applies to, because especially with the network space, especially NVIDIA talking about 800 gig and 1.6 terabit and 3.2 terabit that they've got roadmaps for.
Yeah, they're already at 900 gigabyte on their NVLink scale up domain. There is a paper written by Huawei talking about their Ascend GPUs, which are competitive to NVIDIA, where users are deploying CXL style pools of memory, so non-GPU CPU servers to hold KV cache, just get access over the network from the GPUs instead of using NVMe devices or something. So it's getting kind of technical here, but the point is that that the high level point of like, resources will be distributed across a network and then shared by users or client services is just a unrelenting trend.
Yeah. Yeah. It almost seems like, based on, I guess, what I've seen, I'm glad you brought up security, right? Because that's been like a big thing in the telco space of like moving deep packet inspection and other security and routing services basically to the network layer and not having separate firewalls and things like that to pass through. Because number one, it improves speed. Number two, it greatly reduces potential for packet loss. I mean, on and on and on, right? Are we driving towards a world where the network is what you build and everything else becomes just ephemeral? That's my big question, right? Where like, kind of like what AWS has been driving for a while with Lambda, that whole idea of, I don't really care what's what this application is running on. I'm just going to deploy it and it's going to get some amount of compute and some amount of storage. I don't know where it came. I don't know where it comes from, nor do I give a shit. Right. Mm-hmm. Like that whole, like, if take on like infrastructure is ephemeral, it's all about the application kind of concept.
Interesting, man. Yeah. I think, look, you just talked about the NVIDIA roadmap for the interconnect bandwidth, you know, the scale out network. That roadmap from 800 to 1.6 to 3.2 is clearly a doubling every year or 2 years, which would track mm-hmm. with Moore's Law. Not that Moore's Law technically applies to, you know, interconnect bandwidth, but the implication that you're going to build a network and then use it with a diversity of processors over time, but the network stays relatively fixed, kind of implies that the network has a ton of bandwidth that's unused at the start. And I definitely think that people are going to be building new networks over time as they get more bandwidth. But logically, like physically, you know, installing switches and NICs and cables, but logically, the idea that like we have a cloud, a pool of resources that you're going to add and remove computational elements to and from, like a CPU gets added, a GPU gets added to, in order to process the thing that we have coming in. It always implies that you can do this for the flexibility is some benefit over the performance or speed or cost of just fixing the whole thing at one big cluster. Mm-hmm. And man, everybody's in AI is doing multi-data center massive clusters right now. So
right.
I think the networks, the computer at AWS or for, you know, Vercel or something where you're like deploying your first application. But that's probably going to be different than my, you know, world that I always go back to of the AI data center GPUs in it.
Yeah. I mean, the other piece of it too, at least that I think about, is take the hyperscalers off the table for a second. Mm-hmm. The average company you talk to still running on 10 gig at the leaf, right? Or at the Tor level, right? Or maybe they just got to 25 and then they're going to 100 gig spine. And here we are talking about 3.2 terabit per second switches. I think there's a clear, I don't see the, I think there's a clear difference between those two domains. And I don't see at which point they converge, meaning I run my VMware and my enterprise containers and my whatever bare metal on the same network as I run my AI systems, and everything just exists in the ether. You know what I mean? Like that I don't see yet. You know, I don't, and I really don't see that anytime soon.
Yeah. Probably need to see a lot bigger and hotter and more performance CPUs before you start using more than 25 gig.
I mean, it's not even the CPUs that's the problem. It's licensing restrictions. I mean, I can buy right now today a dual 128 core server box, which gives me 256 physical, 512 logical cores, and I can load that thing up on KVM with a ton of virtual machines.
Yeah,
but that's
that thing
free.
Needs bandwidth. If you've got 10 of those in a rack, that needs more than 10 gigs of bandwidth to talk to the next rack.
And that's kind of what I'm saying. If I'm limited to be, you know, to buying hypervisor licenses in 32 core chunks, I'm obviously not going to drive towards that density because it's going to be extremely cost prohibitive for me to do so. But If I'm using something that's KVM based, well, that's a different story, right? Because I'm not paying per core anymore. Maybe I'm paying per socket, or maybe I'm not paying anything at all because I'm using, you know, just off the shelf KVM and I have the technical skills to do that. To me, that seems to be what's holding us back, or holding what we're talking about back.
Right? Yeah. I'm kind of sitting here saying there will be 200 gig at the leaf switch top of rack for standard data center network when there's 1,000 core processor, you know, 10 terabytes of RAM.
Yep.
And sure, the licensing is, you know, per node KVM or something like that, or it's open source. Mm-hmm. Open source Kubernetes on bare metal, let's say. And they just, you know, people kind of go for that. If you take like the old school 100 servers down to a couple of racks stories and apply them to today, refreshing some server from 2020. I mean, I think it's possible. It's just not, I still say the limiting factor is the growth in CPUs. It's not doubling every year or two. You know, we're like, I don't even know if there's a roadmap for 1,000 cores and a CPU, right? Like,
I don't either. I have no idea. That's pretty obscene.
That's 5-10 years away, right?
At least. I mean, we're just barely getting to, at least on the AMD side, right? I mean, we're just barely cracking low hundreds. 1,000 core, and how long has it been, right? Since we came from it, it's been what, 15 years since we were talking about 4 and 6 core servers?
Yeah, well, I'm kind of saying that's the impetus to go for more bandwidth. That's the equivalent of a GPU, which, you know, a core is not a core, but like these GPUs have tens of thousands of FP16 traditional CUDA quote unquote cores within these SMs. So that's each one of those is some process on device that may be communicating with other SMs and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, that's what fundamentally drives the bandwidth consideration on the GPUs that is not there for the CPUs and the interconnect. So anyway, at this point, maybe I'm kind of talking out of both sides of my mouth, because you realistically could build some super crazy 200 scalable, you know, network with 100 gig or 200 gig leaf switches, and then conceivably imagine that that's going to last you for 10, 15 years with nobody upgrading beyond that, you know, bandwidth limitation if they're on like 1025 today. Because that's 100 times the amount of bandwidth that we're talking about. But, or 10 times, whatever.
Interesting stuff.
Hey, good job this week, man. We'll catch you in 1 or 2 or 3 or something.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right, take care, everyone.
Bye.